The year 2013 gave us Midwesterners, us Iowans, all kinds of changes. Also, many joys and sorrows. This hour, we look back at the year in Iowa news that was. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We close the year by recalling the most memorable, important, or significant events in Iowa news from 2013. Some were joyful for many Iowans, like the reinstatement of wrestling to the Olympic Games. Some set the stage for a change in Iowa politics, like the retirement announcements from U.S. Senator Tom Harkin and Congressman Tom Latham. And some were painful, like the kidnapping and murder of Kathleen Shepard. A discussion of the top 2013 Iowa news stories, right after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And on this final day of the year 2013, we look back at the news events we experienced as a community of Midwesterners, a community of Iowans. And we know that through the news, we experience all the joys and the sorrows, many sorrows, of course, in news, and the changes that our communities experience through the news, changes in our lives. So this hour, we want to look back over the past year to remind ourselves of the most significant news in the state and take a moment to reflect on it with our guests. Our guests today, Lyle Muller is with us, executive director and editor at iowawatch.org. Lyle Muller, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be here, Ben.
Also, Doug Burns joining us by phone, co-owner, reporter, columnist with the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, Iowa, also co-owner of the Jefferson Bee and Herald. Doug Burns, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Ben.
And our own Rob Dillard is with us in our Des Moines studio, our interim news director. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Ben.
And, of course, it goes without saying that we're going to pick out, 10 or so stories to focus on this hour. But it's not necessarily the only news. We were limited by time, so we picked out these stories as significant. Want to talk about them? Perhaps there's another story that you would like to mention. We're like to have you join us by social media this hour. Perhaps you want to react to one of the stories that we're going to mention this hour. Why it particularly affected you, or perhaps you want to point to another news event in 2013 that's not on our list. We have some of those on our Facebook page, at Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. So we'd like to have you weigh in, tweet us at IPR Talk, or post something on our Facebook page. Let's talk first of all about the tragedy that made headlines across the state and beyond. In June, a body found by a fisherman in the Des Moines River was that of the abducted 15-year-old Kathleen Shepard. Webster County Sheriff James Stubbs thanked all who helped with the search.
In the city of Dayton, we were robbed of some innocence. It'll never quite be the same, but hopefully time will heal some of those wounds. But the awareness is definitely a lot higher than it ever was before.
Shepard and a friend had been abducted three weeks earlier by 42-year-old Michael Klunder, a registered sex offender. The other girl escaped and alerted authorities. The body was found far downriver from where Shepard had been last seen on May 20th. Her kidnapper hanged himself hours after the abduction. Rob Dillard, you directed the coverage of this story. Your reflections?
It was just heartbreaking. And we sent reporter Duri Biscarin up to report part of that story. Also, our reporter Pat Blank in Cedar Falls was on that story. And as Duri reflected coming home from that piece, while she was there, she was focused, as a reporter would be. But she, as she was driving away from that area, was just broken down, broken into tears as she reflected on what she had heard from the many volunteers that search for Kathleen.
Mm-hmm. Doug Burns, of course, a lot of small towns all over Iowa, and we like to think of our small towns like Dayton, Iowa, as pristine places where things like this don't happen, but we have to remind ourselves it can happen anywhere.
Yes, Ben, and it's not like this culprit just, you know, jumped out of the bush and surprised people. I mean, he in fact did have a record of kidnapping, a criminal record. He was a registered sex offender, and I think this incident really calls into stark relief the need for some sentencing reform. I think a lot of Iowans would like to see some sentencing reform that would bundle some, you know, decriminalization of some nonviolent drug offenses, maybe with stricter penalties for sex offenders. Here in Carroll, in district court, we had a case this year where there was a Minnesota man who'd abused sexually abused a couple of young boys, and he received 5 years. A psychologist had testified in open court that he had a 89% chance of recidivism and, you know, risk of reoffending. Yet he'll be walking out of the Newton Correctional Facility, and I think a lot of our readers just don't see any justice in any sense in keeping a lot of nonviolent drug offenders in our state's prisons while some of these guys walk out after a few years to reoffend.
Mm-hmm. Lyle Muller, your reflections possibly on harsher penalties?
Harsher penalties certainly are being sought, and there are moves underway to try to lobby for that. But one of the things that's interesting about this is that Michael Klunder, in one of his cases, actually could have been convicted of first-degree kidnapping, which would have put him in life or prison, but the jury reduced that to a lesser charge when they came back with the verdict. And so he was able to get out of prison. And that's not to put the blame on the jury. There's a criminal justice system that we have. I think the big tragedy here, besides the loss of life and the violence that was inflicted upon somebody, is that you just have, again, another instance of innocence clashing with the opposite of innocence. And when those two things happen, it's really sad, and it affects personal people.
Lyle Muller with us, Rob Dillard and Doug Burns reflecting on some of the top stories of 2013. That's certainly the top tragedy of 2013. A lot of reflections because of the themes involved there, which Lyle Muller just outlined. Let's talk about another story that got statewide coverage this fall. A 19-year-old man was shot and killed by Ames police after a vehicle pursuit through Ames. Here's how it unfolded. According to police, Tyler Comstock had a dispute with his father. He drove off in his father's pickup truck with a trailer attached. And after the police attempted to pull him over, Comstock sped off at dangerous speeds at several points, ramming police vehicles. And interestingly, there is a video recording of this from a police car that has been viewed many times on the Internet. The police attempted to pull him over. Comstock sped off at dangerous speeds. He rammed police vehicles. The truck crashed into a tree. Police asked Comstock to get out, but he continued attempting to drive. That's when officers fired into the vehicle and Comstock was killed. Now, many questions raised about the pursuit itself, the apparent or supposed danger to pedestrians, the danger to the officers, the use of deadly force. The ruling, though, was justified. Ruled justified by the Story County Attorney, and Ames Police Department is continuing an internal review of this incident. Doug Burns, so the big question here, the debate over justifiable use of force?
Well, you know, certainly if the Ames Police had a gunman loose in the new Ames Middle School and they fired at him, I don't think anybody would be questioning that. And a vehicle can be used to the same lethal ends as a firearm, so I'm really not in the business of second guessing police officers. I don't have a problem with what they did.
Mm-hmm. Lyle Muller, have you seen the video of this?
I have. I was actually in Ames when all of this was taking place. So we were helping out with the Iowa State Daily on something completely different. So we helped the students with public records requests. I think looking at the video is really important. In fact, putting all of the pieces together for this is important if you're trying to figure out whether there was a justifiable use of force, which, by the way, I'm not prepared to make a judgment on. But I can tell you this, that when you listen to just the audio, it sounds as though Ames police were rejecting the request of the person at the headquarters at the end of the dispatch to pull back. But when you watch the video, you see a completely different story. You see police officers trying to keep a distance, pulling back. You see the truck jamming into a squad car. Then you see all of this different activity taking place. And so putting the pieces together with all of the media that were available that were recorded by police was really important when people try to make a judgment on this case.
Rob Dillard.
Yeah, I've seen a chase end up on a university campus like we did. Had police departments across the state reevaluating their chase policies. The Des Moines Police Department reissued and rethought out just when to pull back, when to end the chase. And so I think it really got a lot of police officers in the state thinking about their policies.
Mm-hmm. And watching that video myself, what occurred to me was that it is an important awareness-raising exercise for those of us who are not in law enforcement to see the quick decisions that need to be made. All of the officers, anybody involved in that, would have had high adrenaline levels, and the training really comes to the surface there. But also that split second training, as our veterans, our soldiers have as well.
Yeah, you get one chance to make that decision, and then you live with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's move to a controversy that we covered here on Iowa Public Radio numerous times. A new state board charged with enforcing Iowa's open meetings and open records laws is facing a tough case, continues to. The Des Moines Register is seeking the release of a video it believes to show the mistreatment of a young girl at the Iowa Juvenile Home. This is in Toledo. And in the recap of this story, I'll mention a brief but graphic description of the incident at the home. A former employee at the home faces criminal charges for his actions in restraining a young girl. The Public Information Board heard a description of what's on the video, and this is what you'll hear. A manager at the home describing what the video shows of both the girl and the employee charged in the case.
The girl was on the floor at the time. He was over her and over her back and head, and had at one point had his knee in her back, pressing her head toward the floor. Her head hit the wall.
And advocates for openness in government say the public has a right to see what the manager is describing in that clip, but the board must decide between the competing claims of government transparency, also protecting the confidentiality of the girl. Des Moines attorney Mike Giudice makes the case for the Register here.
An issue is a videotape of a beating of a child, and the excuses that are being given by the state we think don't hold up.
Giudice says transparency laws trump confidentiality laws in this case. He says the image of the girl can be sufficiently blurred to protect her. What are your thoughts on this case, Lyle Mueller?
Well, I need to start by stating that I do think that these videos should be released. So I have a point of view on that. The question is this mental health care or is it something else? And that's where the transparency argument comes into play here, because the Department of Human Services is withholding the release of this, saying that this is treatment for mental health issues. The question that those of us who would like to see this video have is this appropriate treatment of people, period, regardless of whether it's a health care treatment or not. So it's a tough case, and the Public Information Board has a tough decision on its hand. They're trying to uphold what the law is. They're brand new. They're trying to establish their credibility. But I tend to agree with Kathleen Richardson, who's been the lone no vote in the most recent vote on the release of the videos, that there is a public interest in that it will reveal something that is far different than health care treatment.
Mm. Rob Dillard, is that what you would expect?
Yeah, I should also mention here, Ben, that the revelations of the possible mistreatment of these kids up at the juvenile home has led to the closing of the juvenile home. Mm. Those residents are being transferred from that. So it really has a great impact on the community up there as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's turn to another story. This is an Iowa story that looks at the changes in health care, dominant that theme in Iowa as it is across the country with the Affordable Care Act. More than 20 states refusing to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, leaving many Americans below the poverty line with few health insurance options. Now, some states came up with their own low-income health plans, which would give them some of the federal money set aside for Medicaid expansions while writing their own rules. Federal authorities approved Iowa's alternative proposal, the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan, expected to provide insurance to tens of thousands of poor adults, those adults that previously could not qualify for Medicaid for a variety of reasons. Now, the original Affordable Care Act of 2010 required that states expand their Medicaid programs to include more people, but a U.S. Supreme Court ruling struck down that portion of the law. Rob Dillard, this is complicated territory. We're dealing with 50 different states. Iowa is one of them, fitting into this new era of health care in the United States. Can you explain a little bit about where Iowa finds itself in the context of this national transition?
Oh, my. I always hesitate diving into this because so many things have gone on with the launch of the Affordable Care Act. But just last Friday, the Department of Human Services sent out a press release and notes to some 16,000 Iowans who are eligible for Medicaid. And the message was that if you have applied for benefits through the federal website, you need to reapply through the state websites. So there is still some doubt out there about whether these people who believe they will be covered by Medicaid will indeed have insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm. Doug Burns, how are you sensing your readers' confusion in your part of the state, or lack of confusion about this?
It's been interesting, Ben. I think for most Americans, when you hear their reaction to the Affordable Care Act, it's almost like they're watching a soap opera in Spanish on Univision. They have an opinion, yes, but they don't really seem to understand what they're hearing, and often they don't even understand what they're saying themselves. So I think people line up on this issue based on identity politics, whether they are likely to support the president or not to. But I think we'll see that more stories are trickling out about individual experiences with the Affordable Care Act, people able to obtain affordable care, as the title would indicate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are 3 million people under 26 who are now on their parents' plans, and 81% of young Democrats approve the plan. So, long term, I think this will turn for the in the favor of the president when it's. When we have a historical lens to look at it.
But we have to see, Doug Burns, that we are seeing the front end of this. As long as we've been talking about health care on these airwaves, and you've been discussing it in your paper there since, 2010 and before 2010, this is the front end. People get applying for health care plans and getting them. Now we have the second stage of that, whether the benefits will be there when people apply. Lyle Muller, how do you see this?
There's an underlying thing going on here, and that is movement by Governor Branstad and other Republicans who have some philosophical differences with Obamacare. So they are trying to fashion as much local state control as they can over these programs, and that's what's going on in Iowa. That's why in Iowa there is this strange waiver that says that you have to pay a premium if you're at 100 to 133% of the income or the poverty level. That's something in Iowa that doesn't exist in other places. So that's sort of the underlying thing. And what it means for those of us out here as Iowans who are trying to understand the whole health care program is that we're hearing multiple stories and we have to sort it out.
Mm-hmm. We are asking or looking at the top stories from 2013 on this, the last day of the year. My guests, Lyle Muller, executive director and editor at iowawatch.org, Rob Dillard of Iowa Public Radio, and Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carolyn. We've been asking you if you'd like to comment on any of the stories that we're reflecting on, please go to our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, and post something there, or tweet us at IPR Talk. One reaction from a listener, we were asking for joys and sorrows found in the news from Ben and Jerry on our Facebook page. The turducken at Augusta Restaurant, that story gave us much joy. Now, this is a restaurant that specializes in Southern cuisine, and a turducken, as explained on Charity Nebbe's show, is a deboned chicken stuffed inside of a deboned duck and stuffed inside of a deboned turkey and baked. Something that ever eaten, Doug Burns?
No, but it sounds like something we could probably round up pretty quickly out here in the, the area of Carroll County.
A wild version of it, maybe?
It'd probably go pretty good with Templeton Rye from 15 miles away.
Before we have to go to break, let's talk a little bit about one of the other news stories here and why it caught fire. An off-duty state investigator reported seeing a speeding vehicle that was transporting Iowa's governor, Terry Branstad, to an official event. Now, that investigator was later fired. State officials say there was no connection between those two incidences, the reporting of the speeding and the firing. The investigator, though, sued the state. The driver was cited for speeding, and the public safety director was fired. It was the second speeding incident involving Terry Branstad's official vehicle. The first incident happened in April. Later, governor vowed that the state troopers that drive him around the state would not speed. Lyle Mueller, why did this story spark such controversy, well, have such legs in 2013?
Because it's political. That's really the reason it's political, because if you think about it, the governor speeding isn't impacting you or me as the health care programming is. But it's interesting. It happened in the summer, and it involved a governor who, you know, is kind of a law and order guy when he talks. He's a conservative. I think what happens here is that we just get kind of wrapped up in things. And also there were some strong personalities involved in this. I think it's an important news story because it talks to the judgment and character issues, and people can make judgments about that. And I'm not going to tell them what their judgment ought to be, but it just caught interest because, one, the sort of the discrepancy of the top elected official in the state being in a car that was speeding, but then, two, the fact that it happened more than once.
Mm-hmm. This was no doubt many times in the Daily Times Herald in Carroll. Doug Burns, what do you see the appeal of this story?
Well, when this story broke, I wrote a column about it suggesting that Governor Branstad had to be hiding in the trunk or the back of the car. I just didn't believe that he, as his trooper was just smoking by other vehicles, that his claim that he didn't understand that they were speeding. I just didn't find that that credible.
And Doug, make it clear to us, smoking by is no exaggeration. What, we had a 65 or 70 mile an hour speed limit, and how fast
hard
was
90?
90?
He's going a hard, a clock 98 on a hard 90. I think were two of the terms that were used, and that's a stretch of North Central Iowa. But I think any 2 week Capitol Hill intern or anybody that spent time around politicians know. That they like to get to the next event quickly, and that they're always on the prowl for more time, and that shortcuts and speeding make for a happy candidate. I think at the end of the day, this is reckless, and it shows that Governor Branstad and people who drive at those speeds really care more about the moments they save from themselves than the years of life they may take from people who get involved in accidents as a result of those decisions.
Rob Dillard, about 30 seconds before we have to go to break. Your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think they're absolutely right. The story speaks to privilege in political office, and it's not going to die. This story will carry over to 2014. Special Agent Larry Hedlund's lawsuit against the department is still out there, so we don't know the results of it yet.
Rob Dillard with us, along with Lyle Mueller of iowawatch.org and Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald with us, reflecting on some of the top news stories of 2013. Still to come, we've got several others. Wrestling fans, you'll want to stay tuned. A roller coaster of emotions for us in 2013. Also, the lack of a farm bill, the controversy over the World Food Prize, and the many changes in the political landscape here in Iowa. We're looking at the top Iowa news of 2013. We hope you'll join us on our social media. What sparked a joy or a sorrow in you? Back in just a moment with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This final day of 2013, we're reserving to look back at the news events that we experienced as Iowans, as Midwesterners, and reflecting on them with my guests, Lyle Mueller, Executive Director and Editor at iowawatch.org. Doug Burns of the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, where he is co-owner, reporter, columnist with that paper, also co-owner of the Jefferson Bee and Herald, and our own Rob Dillard, interim news director at Iowa Public Radio. We'd like to have you chip in your thoughts. Perhaps you think we overlooked something. We're not doing a sort of a top 10 list. We're just reflecting on some of the big stories. that happened. And please join us with your reactions via social media. Post to our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. As a matter of fact, in the break, a Facebook post from our own Dean Borg came across. Dean writes, I believe a major story was the adverse weather that prevented more than 500,000 acres of cropland to be planted in 2013. Lyle Muller, very wet spring.
Dean speaks with great wisdom on that one. This was a roller coaster year, really, for Iowa, because earlier in the year, we were preparing for floods. In Iowa City and Cedar Rapids and other places, the memory of only 5 years ago was pretty deep. As we were preparing for those floods, a funny thing happened, and funny in not the ha-ha sense, and that is the weather turned dramatically, and we ended up with drought. And so what we couldn't get crops planted to begin with, and then couldn't get anything to germinate, and it was kind of a rough year. And so I think that that was a major story of the year, dealing with the weather out there. There's a sidebar to that, and that is some of the flood relief that places like Cedar Rapids and Iowa City are finally getting from 5 years ago in terms of FEMA money and money getting freed up. So, yeah, it was a pretty rough year. We again experienced Iowa weather, but there was a huge economic impact because of it.
Another big story in the year, we just heard in our news the passing of Johnny Orr, the iconic figure at Iowa State University in their sports program there. But this year, fans of wrestling had a roller coaster of emotions as one of the oldest Olympic sports was dropped from the 2020 Olympics list of core sports. Craig Sesker is the communication manager for USA Wrestling. He was on this program. That's the national governing body of amateur wrestling in the United States. On this program, this was his reaction to the original announcement back in February that wrestling would be dropped.
We were very surprised and stunned by the news, as many of the people were around the world. And you know, we were aware that a vote was coming, but we really hadn't received. We had talked with the U.S. Olympic Committee and some of our contacts, and we really didn't understand a lot of the reasoning behind that. We were basically blindsided by it.
Then later, leading up to a final decision in September, wrestling advocates argued that the sport should be reinstated by the International Olympic Committee, or IOC. But there was only one spot and three sports clamoring for it. We had baseball and softball pitted against squash, pitted against wrestling. Well, wrestling was reinstated. And afterwards, Iowa State University head coach Kevin Jackson agreed with those that called the move a rebirth.
I think it just gives us an opportunity to really move wrestling to the next level, and I think that's what the IOC did with their decision. And I'm just looking forward to us getting better, stronger, and growing from being put in this situation and moving forward.
University of Iowa Associate Head Coach of Wrestling Terry Brands on this program had a similar reaction. He says it was important for this to have happened.
I just didn't see it as a mistake by the IOC, but more as a mandate to get our ducks in a row and quit screwing around and get rid of the arrogant and the pompous people and move forward the way that, you know, you're supposed to as a representative to the Olympics.
Straight talking Terry Brands there on our program. Some chuckles. Lyle Muller. Wrestlers talk like that, Lyle.
Yeah, they do. reporters love them because there are no secrets, and you just get straightforward answers. They're very focused. When you get people like Kevin Jackson and the Brands brothers, Dan Gable, John Smith down at Oklahoma State, and Cale Sanderson at Penn State all rallying behind something like this and on the same team, something magical is happening. It's good that wrestling is in there. It's important for Iowa, certainly, but it's also important for the sport. Wrestling is one of the old traditional sports dating back to the old Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Doug Burns, what do you make of this? A real wake-up call for the sport, isn't it?
Well, wrestling is as Lyle just mentioned, it's a foundational support. So if we could resurrect the founders of the Olympics in Greece, I'm sure they would have voted with our interests here in Iowa. It'd be awfully hard to watch the Olympics absent wrestling and then see, you know, beach volleyball and some
right.
of these other sports that yeah. are you know, sort of made for TV. But I have to give some credit to a Carroll County native on this one,
sure.
Scott Sipker, the young man who's made all those Iowa Nice videos that have gone viral. He got together with Tom Arnold and some other Hollywood folks and made some pretty effective videos advocating for wrestling. So I know those videos got around the country. And
we had him on our program to talk about those videos. Yes, it was a great approach to it. Now, changes I think we know about coming to the sport. You mentioned volleyball there. I think wanting to make wrestling more appealing, changes we know about that I discussed with a gentleman you just heard in those clips there. Two weight classes dropped for men, two added for women. Now there will be, as I understand, 2 3-minute rounds instead of 3 2-minute rounds. Other changes will reveal themselves as it goes on. Rob Dillard, your thoughts?
Well, I was want to point out that it was a rare sign of bipartisanship in Iowa. Every major elected official signed letters in support of wrestling, whether Republican or Democrat. So it really signaled to me how important this sport is to the state of Iowa, the popularity of the high school wrestling tournament, of course, and the strength of programs at Iowa, Iowa State, UNI, Grandview, Wartburg. I mean, there's just a great amount of interest in the sport of wrestling.
Yeah, and we'll wait and see if in the next Summer Olympics if we have competitors entering the ring to their own theme music with capes on. Something in that direction. I don't think they'll take it quite that far, but we'll have to see. Farmers and others heading into a new year without a farm bill again, certainly a top story of 2013. Also happening last year, a bill that provides government support for farmers and ranchers. Divisions in Congress involve disagreements about the nutrition programs that account for most of the bill's spending. Farmers say it's difficult to plan their crops and make other business decisions without a farm bill. And lawmakers say they hope to pass a new 5-year farm bill early in January. But farmers are left to wait. Doug Burns assigned one of the aspects of the what's been called the do-nothing Congress. How is it impacting people in your part of the state? What are you hearing?
Well, I think the operative word you just used, Ben, and that is indecisiveness, that it makes it difficult to make decisions when the business of farming is unpredictable enough that when you do take out some of the components that you can make predictable, that's just really unfair. But I think this draws into stark relief what we're going to have happen when we lose U.S. Senator Tom Harkin and some of the clout we have with agriculture. You look at the lack of the farm bill, also look at the assault on the renewable fuel standard, and you just wonder if when Harkin's not there working with Grassley, if Iowa can afford to have a congressman like Steve King out there asleep at the wheel on some of these key issues and howling at the moon politically to the far right. He's not taking care of some of the basic business that needs to be done for our farmers out here in western and central Iowa.
Rob Dillard?
I wish I had Amy Mayer with me. She's been following
me. Yes, she has been doing a tremendous job covering our agricultural reporting, isn't she?
It does put into doubt. I mean, Doug is absolutely right. Farmers really count on knowing what's going to happen. I think there will be a farm bill. It just as they keep kicking it down the road, and that's it's a shame.
Okay. You mentioned Tom Harkin's announcement of his retirement, his coming retirement. Let's go there and talk a little bit for a few minutes about the changing political landscape in our state. Retirement announcements both from U.S. Senator Tom Harkin and later, just a few weeks ago, Congressman Tom Latham of Iowa's 3rd District, the newly reconstituted 3rd District. Doug Burns, how is that being interpreted out there? That was a surprise. Let's go to Latham first, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The announcement by Latham, particularly the timing of it, I believe it was it wasn't on Christmas Eve. It was just a couple days before. So that really did open up a lot of opportunities for a number of politicians. Polk County and Des Moines, of course, and Council Bluffs are in that district. So the opportunities are almost limitless for the politically ambitious. And there would be the potential for some people who may not have gained traction in the Republican field in the U.S. Senate race to slide over to the Iowa House race in Latham's district. I think what you're seeing with the Republican Party nationally, I would suspect a moderate to conservative Democrat, I'm sorry, moderate to conservative Republican, somebody in the mold of Latham to emerge as the candidate for that party.
Mm-hmm. But does it have the potential to change Iowa's status as a purple swing state? We have 2-2 in the Congress to the two major parties. What are your thoughts on that, Doug Burns? Could the Democrats take the third district?
I think it'll remain Republican, but absolutely the Democrats could, and there's a strong candidate right now in Apple in the district running in that district. But Tom Latham served in basically three separate congressional territories, three separate areas. So I don't think it'd be unthinkable for Christy Vilsack, who ran a very credible race in a district that was lined up against her, to maybe make a move and run as a Democrat in that district.
Mm-hmm. I guess Eliah Mueller.
A lot of history is going to go by the wayside when these two men leave Congress. Tom Harkin joined the Iowa House in 1975, the Senate in 85, Latham the House in 95. So those are a lot of years of experiences and seniority that get built up. I think it's really interesting that Latham has chosen to do this so close after running against Leonard Boswell, when you had two incumbents going against each other. So that was a big surprise, I think, for Latham.
Interesting, which was the question, why after the redistricting and the hard fight against Boswell, why would you give it up after only one term?
Yeah, that's a good question for Latham, and I don't know it's been asked yet. And maybe it doesn't matter in the scheme of things. Maybe it's just he's ready to move on.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you're in eastern Iowa generally. Eliah Mueller, Bruce Braley, the only declared candidate for the Democrats, a host of Republicans vying for Tom Harkin's seat. Do you see Bruce Braley as having pretty much a lock on this, unless something unforeseen happens?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think anybody ever has locks except Chuck Grassley and Tom Harkin. but certainly, I think Bruce Braley could be considered to be in the driver's seat, and for this reason. The Democratic Party is united behind him. They have already gotten rid of opposition to him for any kind of primary challenge, any significant opposition. He does have some kind of name recognition for being in the House. He has not been tied to scandals, at least anything that you would call a bona fide scandal. You know, Republicans will find things to attack him for, but it'll be based on his record. So I think and then you'll have the Republicans all vying to try to get someone to get that kind of name recognition and that kind of unity in their party. I think Braley's in a good spot right now, but things can always change in elections.
And Ben, I would just add, I think there might be the potential for some more Republican candidates to enter the U.S. Senate race. Right now, the field, I would describe it as underwhelming. Of course, Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds is lined up behind Joni Ernst. I haven't really seen much out of her. I would view Mark Jacobs, who's going to be very well funded, the former Houston Energy Company CEO. I would put him in the carpetbagger category. And I think there's room for another candidate even in the next couple of months for the Republicans in the U.S. Senate. Right?
Let me ask you this, Doug Burns, about Bruce Braley's traction there in the central and western part of the state. I noticed on my first ever RAGBRAI across the state that also in the central and western part of the state that there were Bruce Braley signs. So he's long since started this race.
Well, you know, he's a rural – I mean, he has some rural connections in his family. I mean, he's from Brooklyn and Brooklyn, Iowa, it's on the other side of Interstate 35 from us. It's, very, very similar. And I think he is a genuine Iowan who resonates with people here. Certainly, if the race is nationalized, any Republican could emerge with some advantages, but I don't think that the field right now contains a candidate who can go toe-to-toe with Braley in a debate. I mean, can you imagine any of the current candidates right now even standing on the same stage with him and making it through the first 10 minutes? I can't.
Rob Dillard.
Yeah, may I dare mention the open seats in the 3rd District and the 1st District, perhaps opening the possibility for the first woman to be elected to Congress from the state of Iowa. We'd separate ourselves from the state of Mississippi if that happened.
Right. We only have the two states in the union that have not elected women to represent us, represent the states in Washington.
Yeah, Doug mentioned Stacey Apple, strong candidate in the 3rd District. What if Joni Ernst moved over and ran for that seat instead of the Senate seat? I don't know if that will happen. Three of the five Democratic candidates in the first district are women. There's some possibility out there.
Mm-hmm. Let's look unashamedly 2 years into the future. 2 years from now, we'll be in the final days before the 2016 Iowa caucuses. From this distance, what can be said about the coming race, Doug Burns?
Well, right now, I'd say wide open. It's going to be exciting once again to have two, you know, full-throated races on the Republican side for sure. And then if Hillary Clinton doesn't get in on the Democratic side, I think you'll start to see all sorts of names that those of us who follow politics know, but that just folks don't maybe recognize. So Hillary Clinton would be, I'd say, obviously according to the Iowa poll that the Des Moines Register conducted, she's the runaway leader on the Democratic side. And Republican
for the second
race,
time.
Yes. Yeah, well, we know what happened in 2008. And on the Republican side, that's caught up in a the national conflict that's going on within the Republican Party. So whether Chris Christie even decides to campaign in Iowa would in fact be an open question.
Right. And the Iowa GOP is certainly going to up its game as far as counting votes after the counting kerfuffle damaging who knows how much Iowa's leadoff status with Rick Santorum days after the caucuses actually winning over Romney by, what was it, Lyle Muller?
I guess it was 8 votes. And, you know, and there's so much attention given to what basically is a straw poll, because those polls that are taken by the Republican Party are meaningless to some degree during the caucuses, because the real business is done after the votes are taken and delegates are selected to the county convention. And those delegates are the ones who have that presidential power, say. We're going to have a lot of company here.
Okay.
It's going to be a great year to be a political reporter in 2015.
Let's jump to one more story in 2013 that we didn't touch on. So many stories that we haven't mentioned this hour that were very important, but let's touch on this one. The World Food Prize, commonly referred to as the Nobel Prize of Agriculture. This year it went to 3 biotechnology pioneers. And this choice infuriated some environmental groups. The award winners were honored in October in Des Moines. The 3 laureates, Mark Van Montague, Mary Dell Chilton, and Robert T. Fraley, interviewed on this program as well. 3 scientists whose individual discoveries led to the creation of genetically modified crops. Part of that discussion was answering some of the criticisms when they appeared on this program. A few listeners suggested that the technology was unsafe, that it only benefits large agribusiness companies to the detriment of the family farmer. Fraley responded, saying that safety has been a big priority and that science has been deliberate and appropriate.
It needs to start with the reality that, you know, this is a very, very specific type of genetic modification, you know, and man has been, you know, genetically modifying crops and farm animals since the beginning of time. And all of the research that's been done, both for the regulatory bodies around the world and for so many independent scientists, there's literally been, you know, thousands of studies and reports that that point to the safety of the technology.
Robert T. Fraley there on this program several months ago. By 2012, GMOs were grown on more than 170 million hectares around the globe by 17.3 million farmers. But again, they remain controversial, as we found out on our program, over that program. Lyle Muller, weigh in on the significance of this controversial pick for the World Food Prize.
I think a lot of the controversy has to do with the involvement of Syngenta and Monsanto corporations that are represented in these awards. They're corporations that sometimes get attacked for some of their business practices. Monsanto gets attacked for hiring practices at times and some of the things they're doing. Hiring practices, that is, for migrant farm workers. The GMOs are here and they do exist. And there is an argument, a great argument that's made about how low subsistence farmers are using these things to have better yields and protect themselves from swings in the weather and pests and things like that. And so that argument exists out there. The bottom line comes down to who profits from this. That's my view, at least. That is it large companies and their shareholders profiting, or is it the farmer that's profiting? There's a strong argument that if it's a perfect world, both would. But the balance here is where the controversy comes. Where does the balance come?
Rob Dillard, can I give you the last word in a few seconds on this World Food Prize controversy?
Well, it may not have been what the World Food Prize wanted in making the selection, but I think opening the debate over GMOs was a healthy thing, and I was glad to see that happen.
Mm-hmm. So many things we didn't get to mention this hour as we close. We had the high-tech companies, Rob, Facebook, Google, Microsoft building, expanding data centers in Iowa.
$1.4 billion in investment from three major high-tech companies.
Amazing.
In Iowa.
Also didn't get mentioned the investment banker Russell Wassendorf's $200 million fraud. A couple of the news items we didn't get to, but I want to thank you all, Rob Dillard, Lyle Muller, and Doug Burns, for joining us with your reflections on some of the major news in 2013. We appreciate it, gentlemen.
Glad to be here.
You're welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury, in Ames help from Jason Burns today. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk show is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and to all in yours, we from Iowa Public Radio, all of us wish you a very happy and healthy new year. Until 2014, thank you.